We'll start the recording. Hopefully everybody's doing well this morning. It's good to see everyone. We'll continue our study here in the book of Job. So on Thursday, and I apologize it went out kind of late, but I sent out a write-up of chapter 11. So we're going to try to, in an attempt to finish the class in a reasonable amount of time, we're going to try to summarize some chapters that I'll send via email, and then we'll talk about some stuff here. And I'm sure there'll be some overlap, and we'll kind of, you know, figure that out as we go. Hopefully you got that. Hopefully you've had a chance to look at it, and you've got chapter 11 fresh on your mind. But we'll go through a quick recap from that. So in chapter 11. We do have Zophar, who's the third of Job's friends, who's going to speak up. We now have his rebuke of Job. And some of the things that were pointed out are, you know, something that we see is continued throughout the whole book. When someone's about to speak, they feel this need to justify why they're speaking and why it's important. So that's something that Zophar does as well, but we see that with Job. We see that with Eliphaz and Bildad, and later on Elihu, you know, they all say, like, here's why I need to say something. So he says that, and basically he's saying that I don't just have a right to speak, but someone needs to say something. Like, are we going to let this guy get away with this? You know, it's kind of what his tone is. So some of the other things we pointed out in Zophar's rebuke of Job, there is a little bit of irony. And that if you read what Zophar says, especially in the first few verses, he speaks very forcefully against Job. He tells Job that you deserve worse than what's happening to you. So very forcefully. And there's a little bit of irony in Zophar speaking so forcefully for God, yet he's saying things like, who can know the deep things of God? Right? So a little bit of irony there, a little bit of compartmentalization happening there in Zophar's minds. And in general, just when we find ourselves having to compartmentalize and what we're saying applies to him but not me, that's not where we want to be when we're talking. So there is a little bit of compartmentalization, or maybe Zophar lacking some self-awareness in saying these things so forcefully, but also saying, you know, who can know the deep things of God? One of the things that was pointed out was how Zophar seems to draw from some images that Job uses when Job is speaking. And that happens three or four times in Zophar's rebuke of Job. He references a donkey of a man, which is something that Job mentioned. And Zophar brings it back around to that and uses that imagery to turn it back around on Job a little bit. He mentions like waters that pass away. He mentions the suffering that Job is enduring will be like waters that pass away, which calls to mind when Job rebukes his friends by accusing them of being torrential streams that pass away. So very similar wording there. And then, of course, he talks about how, you know, Job, your life can be brighter than the noonday and darkness like the morning. Turning around what some of what Job had said in chapter 3 and also in chapter 10 about preferring darkness to light. So he kind of turns around that image again on Job. So that's kind of a recurring thing that Zophar seems to do in his rebuke. And when we look at the rebuke as a whole, I think it was obviously intended to get Job to repent, although it isn't abundantly clear yet what exactly they believe Job did wrong, other than the things that he's saying now. Their argument kind of depends on Job must have done something to deserve this, but they haven't been able to put their finger on exactly what. But nevertheless, Job needs to repent. And I think he's also genuinely trying to reinstill a sense of hope in Job, because Job's speaking very hopelessly. And he brings it back around towards the end of his rebuke, talking about how there will be hope. So he wants his friend to have hope. And again, let's not miss the fact that his friends so far have nothing to accuse him of, other than the things that he's saying. But there is a real difference between two approaches. So consider taking the approach of, you hear Job saying these things and you say, Job, maybe you shouldn't be saying things like that. You don't want to add transgression to your suffering. and taking that approach, and I'm not saying that's even the best approach, but that's different than what his friends are doing. What his friends are doing are saying, you're guilty of something, and what you're saying now only proves how in rebellion you actually are. And those are two very different approaches. The first statement would be focused more on Job's well-being and not assuming evil of him. But the second is assuming he did something evil. It's assuming he did something evil. And it also, you can pick up, as we've talked about in the last classes, on the defensive tone of that, right? Job accuses his friends of having fear, of being afraid, and I think that you see some defensiveness in their tone, that they feel like they need to defend what they think is right about God, but it's as much focused on ensuring that what they believe is right as it is on helping their friend Job. So, just for whatever it's worth, and that's something that Job is going to come back around to in chapter 13 and spend some time rebuking them on. According to Job, when we get there, he'll say that you're showing partiality here. And yeah, you're showing partiality towards God, but not in a fair and honest way. You're defending him at any and every expense, at the expense of even listening to what I have to say. And Job's even going to tell them, like, and do you think God is impressed with that? Do you think that he won't be like, no, you're not being honest there in their zeal to defend him? So interesting that as we get there, Job believes that that God would actually agree with him in his own assessment of what's going on. So we're going to get into chapter 12, but before I do, I'll ask if there were any questions or comments from chapter 11 before we move on. Anything about Zophar's rebuke of Job? Sounds like I covered everything. Okay, Job chapter 12. So now we're going to get Job's response to Zophar. Verses 1 and 2. Then Job answered and said, no doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you. Let's spend a moment appreciating the humor. That's some wicked sarcasm there that Job's using. Yeah, that's pretty brutal, but pretty funny. Verse 3, he says, but I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Who does not know such things as these? So a couple of things to point out here as we start thinking about what Job's about to say. Job is, in a sense, able to put himself in his friend's shoes. He can see how this looks from their perspective, and he can understand their arguments. And it's important for him to show them that he sees it from their perspective and that he understands their arguments, because he's going to try to show them, I know where you are, and you're not keeping up. I've already considered that. I've already thought about that. And a lot of what he's going to say now is going to be covering those things that his friends are trying to tell him so he can prove he understands what they're saying. Similar to kind of chapter 9, he got into that a little bit too. But it's important for him to demonstrate, I get it. I know what you're saying, but you're not keeping up with me here. I'm past you. I've already considered that, and now I'm further along than where you are in your thinking. And I think that he might also be perhaps trying to demonstrate to them some of the behavior that he would like shown to him. He's showing them, here's where you are and all your stuff, and I get that. And I don't disagree with a lot of it. But he's not getting any of that in return. And maybe he would like for them, okay, look, I'm looking at it from your perspective. Why don't you try looking at it from mine? And a couple of places in these chapters, he's going to say, look, just stop talking and listen to what I have to say. So he wants them to just consider what he has to say and to do it fairly. So now we get into verses 4 and 5. And some of these passages to me were a little bit challenging, so I'll try to work through what I think they mean. I'd be happy to try to get your thoughts on them, but some of this isn't obvious. And on some of these verses, again, there's a lot of discrepancy, not only between commentators on the subject, but also between translations. Some of the translations, the way they're rendered, could really impact the meaning of what's being said, because there's some uncertainty as to what the Hebrew actually meant. So verses 4 and 5, Job says, "I am a laughingstock to my friends. I, who called to God and he answered me, a just and blameless man, am a laughingstock. In the thought of one who is at ease, there is contempt for misfortune. It is ready for those whose feet slip." So this verse 5 is one of those passages that's kind of difficult. I like going to, I don't always agree 100% with any commentary that I read, but I think Albert Barnes is one I go to a lot, and he's worked into my app, which is convenient. But I think he gives a pretty coherent explanation of how this could be taken. So to summarize his thoughts, he would say that Job used to be a man who, while he was prosperous, people respected him. And while he was prosperous, people went to him for wise counsel. But now that this disaster has come upon him, his wisdom is basically esteemed as worthless. Like, because of his calamity, people aren't listening to him. And he's, as evidenced by his three friends, he feels like they're not listening to him. And that's not really reasonable to believe that the value of a man's wisdom depends on his prosperity, right? His prosperity is irrelevant to a man's wisdom, and wisdom can be achieved through many different experiences, good and bad, with many different outcomes, positive and negative. So the idea there would be, in the thought of one who is at ease, there is contempt for misfortune. Job is calling out his friends for not thinking much of his words on the basis of his misfortune. And he's kind of, again, speaking sarcastically, saying like, hey, you have comfort and ease, so you must be right. You know, and no, not exactly. So then when it says, it is ready for those whose feet slip, the "it" would refer to his misfortune, meaning that in the minds of those who are being hypocritical in their judgments, misfortune's only going to happen to people who deserve it. Which, that all kind of fits what Job's been talking about and what his friends have been saying. So that fits the context. The King James Version, so I read from the ESV up here. The King James Version is actually quite a bit different. It says, "He that is ready to slip with his feet is as a lamp despised in the thought of him that is at ease." So the King James actually brings into this imagery of his lamp that's not even in the ESV, which is kind of interesting. So now you've got a word image that, by the way, Albert Barnes was drawing from, because he was referring to the King James when he was doing his commentary. But you've got this word image of a lamp that's now contributing to comprehending this passage, that the lamp is despised. So again, it kind of goes along with what Barnes was proposing, that when you think about this light, that when it's working, people come to it, it's usable, it's helpful, but when it's broken, people just throw it away. There's just, you know, contempt, supposedly, for this lamp that's broken. And he feels like, again, when he was prosperous, he was like this beacon of light that people would come to, they were drawn to for wisdom and encouragement. But now that he's been suffering, he's the broken lamp, he's getting thrown away. He feels like he's esteemed as worthless by his friends. So that's kind of where Albert Barnes is. And, you know, the point of that would be for Job telling his friends, look, it's really easy for you to figure all this out when you're not going through any type of suffering like I am. It's really easy to offer a perspective on something when you're not the one being put through it. So that's one take on this. But admittedly, that's kind of a complicated verse, and there's surprisingly a lot of different views and commentary on it. Yeah, Kelly? Yeah.
It was ready, you know, and it sounds like you could be saying the feet slipping are their feet. In other words, their feet have slipped in their ascertainment of his wrongdoing.
Yeah, it could be that. I mean, that would fit too. Yeah, I don't disagree with that. That absolutely fits. Any other, did I see another hand? so just know there's a little variation there in how that's translated and also how it's understood, but all these thoughts kind of come back to, and that's what makes a, just a side point, you know, when you have things like this in the Bible where there is differences in understanding and even differences in translation, note that all of the perspectives that we're offering up, and if you want to dig into this more that you can find, they all still kind of feed this same context, and they fit within the context of what's being said, so that there's not like one completely different view and another completely different view that changes how we would understand what the book of Job is about, right? I mean, we can contextualize this, and that's what people who are interpreting this are doing. They're leaning heavily on the context, and they're trying to make it fit the stuff that's easier to understand, which is just a good practice for all of us, right? When something's a little tricky, well, let's put it in its context and let's try to make it make sense in its context and not just, you know, come up with something way off in the weeds. So let's move on. Verse 6, Job continues, "The tents of robbers are at peace, and those who provoke God are secure, who bring their God in their hand." So this is another difficult verse that's been translated differently. Couple of options here. It could be that Job is subverting those who are at ease but despise him as the ones who are going to be judged. He's saying, you know, if that's the case, you know, you guys, you're the robbers and your tents are at peace, but you're really provoking God, even though you think you have security now, but God sees that. And that fits, you know, and implicit in that would be you're taking God's blessings for granted, you know, while you're provoking him to anger, you're not appreciating it. Another option is Job could be doubling down on his statement in chapter 9, verses 22 through 24 that we had found so problematic before when he says God doesn't see any difference between the blameless and the wicked. In verse 24, chapter 9, Job says, "The earth is given into the hand of the wicked." And if that's what he's referring back to here in chapter 12, then he's kind of restating that point. He would just be stating in a general sense, look, the tents of robbers are at peace, and those who provoke God are secure. You know, like God doesn't really, he's not doing anything about this. It could be something along those lines. He could be saying, like, here's just more evidence that God sees no difference between the blameless and the wicked. You know, the health and peace and prosperity of people who are not doing what's right. So that could go either way. Again, both kind of fit the context, but it could go either way. So verses 7 through 10. "But ask the beasts, and they will teach you, the birds of the heavens, and they will tell you, or the bushes of the earth, and they will teach you, and the fish of the sea will declare to you, who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In his hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind." So again, I'll throw up a couple options. this chapter, I'm not taking a hard stand on a lot of stuff. I'm going to throw some options out there as to what this passage means. In verses 7 through 10, he could be saying that what's going on, what's happening to me, it's so obvious that you could go to the beasts of the field, you could go to the fish in the water, you could go to the bushes, and they could tell you what's going on. That's how obvious it is, okay? But somehow you're not getting it. So it could be something along those lines. Or Job might be pointing out that as has happened with him and all of his suffering, suffering happens to all other creatures as well. He's saying you could go ask the birds, you can go ask the fish, you can go ask the bushes that are cut down or burned up or dry up because they don't have any water. They would tell you that bad things happen at no fault to the object that's going through the suffering or the misery. You know, implicit would be, what could a fish do to deserve living a hard life? What could a bush do to deserve dying of thirst or getting cut down, right? So the point would be, Coming back around to verse 10 when he says, in his hand, or in verse 9, who among us does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? So that God is responsible, or at least at a minimum, has allowed it to happen. So he says, in his hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind. So that would just go back to our discussion last week we had on why God would create things that would continually suffer. Because maybe he's saying that. Maybe he's saying like, well, look, all these things are suffering and I'm suffering. And it doesn't mean that I'm guilty. It doesn't mean the bush did anything to deserve it, right? I didn't do anything to deserve it, but God's making it happen anyway. And that could be Job's point. I recapped in the email I sent some of the discussion points on getting into why God would create and then allow to suffer. If you're not familiar with that or beefed up on that or you didn't get the email, let me know. I'll send those thoughts out to you, but I won't retread them here. But there's a lot of ground to cover in that. Yeah, Kelly?
I was thinking back, like, for instance, in Revelation chapter 10, where he tells some faithful brethren that they're going to suffer 10 days. They're going to be thrown in prison, but I'm going to see you through this. You know, be faithful unto death, and I'll give you a crown of life. Even indicated some of those Christians, some of those brothers would be killed, but they were going to have a better thing.
Yeah.
So it's something maybe we have trouble understanding and accepting, that God will allow us to suffer sometimes, but that suffering is for our good. Or God may not allow us to suffer sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, but whatever decision he makes, it's the right decision.
Yeah.
For us.
And that's made evident in Job, because as the readers, we see the whole context, right? We understand more about what God's doing than Job can see. And we know where it's going. You know, we know that God's going to pull Job through it. And Job didn't have that perspective. But, you know, as we talked about, this isn't all that different than a lot of skeptical criticisms of God that exist today. You know, why would God create me if there was even a chance I might go to hell? That doesn't seem right. That doesn't seem just. Yeah, he makes the rules, but then he can also decide, why wouldn't he just create me to put me in eternity forever, you know, and with him.
Mm-hmm. Think about our own faith. Do we struggle with the concept that God could allow us to suffer? And how do we process that?
Yeah. And I think there's a lot to be taken from Job pertaining to that as well. You know, a lot of the things that Job's friends say are on point. You know, about Job, you should not abandon hope. You know, you should have hope. And that hope has to carry us through difficult times, I think. That faith that God is going to make things right, and it's working together for good, somehow, some way, even if I don't see the whole picture. So that does imply faith and needing to grow in faith and being tested in our faith. And again, all this, you know, one of the things we talked about, and I think very rightly so last week, is how easy is it for us who aren't suffering to talk about these things, you know? And, you know, let's properly contextualize how we approach that topic. When someone we love or know is going through a difficult time, maybe it's not the time to be talking about how God makes everything work together for his good. Maybe, as Sean made a great point in his lesson last week, what did Jesus do? Did he explain to everybody who was suffering when he was ministering to them, why God allowed them to suffer, why they were born this way, or did he serve them and heal them? Some of them, there was a little bit of explanation, but for most of them, you know, it was more beneficial to be healed than to understand why I'm suffering. I'd rather not be suffering than to say, oh, okay, that makes sense. Yeah. So anyway, let's move on back in Job chapter 12. Verses 11 and 12, Job says, "Does not the ear test words as the palate tastes food? Wisdom is for the aged, and understanding in length of days." So I read this to mean Job is telling his friends, again, to listen to what he's saying. He's saying, test words like your palate would taste food. And then this idea of wisdom being with the aged. I think that seems to contrast this idea he presented before, where he's rebuking the idea of wisdom being associated with being prosperous. Saying, no, you know, the people who aren't wealthy and prosperous and doing great, those aren't the ones who necessarily have wisdom. It's those who have gone through a lifetime of experiences. Hear that, right? Just because I'm suffering doesn't mean what I'm saying is worthless. And then in this next section, which we'll read in its entirety, verses 13 through 25, again, I think it's Job reaffirming to his friends that he understands what they're saying. And I think, again, he's trying to pattern for them the kind of response he wants them to show him, in that I can see it from your perspective, so why don't you listen to me? Why can't you try to see it from mine? Why are you locked into this way you're seeing it? But rather consider what I have to say. So we'll go through it, verses 13 through 25. With God are wisdom and might. He has counsel and understanding. If he tears down, none can rebuild. If he shuts a man in, none can open. If he withholds the waters, they dry up. If he sends them out, they overwhelm the land. With him are strength and sound wisdom. The deceived and the deceiver are his. He leads counselors away stripped, and judges he makes fools. He looses the bonds of kings and binds a waistcloth on their hips. He leads priests away stripped and overthrows the mighty. He deprives of speech those who are trusted and takes away the discernment of the elders. He pours contempt on princes and loosens the belt of the strong. He uncovers the deeps out of darkness and brings deep darkness to light. He makes nations great and he destroys them. He enlarges nations and leads them away. He takes away understanding from the chiefs of the people of the earth and makes them wander in a pathless waste. They grope in the dark without light, and he makes them stagger like a drunken man. And then if we go to chapter 13, verses 1 and 2, and again, there weren't like any chapters when this was originally written, so it's the same thought being continued. It says, behold, my eye has seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you. So again, let's understand verses 13 through 25 in chapter 12 as Job recounting to them, here's where you're at. I get you, okay? This is where you're at. I know all this already. You're not teaching me anything I missed, but you're not keeping up with where I am, okay? So I think that's what Job is trying to say. And then to summarize verses 13 through 25, he goes through a lot of the points, obviously, that his three friends have made, because he's trying to show them, I get it. I know where you're coming from. He talks about how God is more powerful than man. He talks about how God is wiser than man. He talks about how God brings low those who puff themselves up, whether they're nations or kings or princes or chiefs or elders. He talks about, in comparison to God, they're about as wise and powerful as a drunken man staggering around in the dark. That's how they are compared to the wisdom and power of God. So, any thoughts from chapter 12 before we move into chapter 13? I'm on fire. Oh, no, there is a comment. Okay.
No, I appreciate the point you made about Jesus' compassion. I think Job's friends on one level are angry with Job. I can sense that, you know, not that they see his suffering, but they're actually some animus for him, you know, that they think he's being a little ridiculous, maybe overdramatic, and making too much of what he's going through. I don't know. I'm speculating a bit, but it's hard to be compassionate.
No. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And yeah, we can put ourselves in that position. I mean, imagine that, you know, one of your closest friends, you became convinced one of your closest friends was now in rebellion against God. You know, how would you feel? Angry? Distraught? Desperate? A little bit afraid. I mean, all these things that are coming out in their answers. They got to watch themselves too, right? I mean, if they're convinced he's in error, they got to watch themselves, and they've even said as much. Like, what you're saying is treacherous. Yeah?
Maybe there is is some value to simply asking, if you see someone suffering and they're not understanding, and if sin is in question, maybe the best thing to do is just to ask them, do you know of anything that you're guilty of? You know? And then if they say no, then love believes all things. And you need to get off that bandwagon.
Right.
And if it is something that's hidden, then maybe even they're struggling to see it, then you gotta leave that to the Lord. And, you know, I'm just trying to think about how you handle some of these situations. And
yeah, although neither scenario is ideal in any sense, I think what we're saying is it's better to assume if your brother's telling you nothing's wrong, that nothing's wrong, than to suspect continually that there is something wrong that he's hiding. It's better to let God work that out with him than to risk the implications of what would happen if you continue to pursue it. Yep.
Well, not, yeah, to Sean's point, not only because we can't know, because we can, right? But at the end of the day, and we see this with Job, right? God's working him through this. This is a process, right? Job is having ups and downs, you know? And at the end of the day, you know, we look at people sometimes, we're all guilty of this, I've done that, and we look at it through a monochromatic lens. They're the same all the time. And if they've been this way in the past, they're always this way, they're always going to be that way. I mean, but we have probably seen enormous changes in people who came to the Lord who we never would have thought that person would have never obeyed the gospel. And they did.
Yeah.
So we do have to leave it to God. You know, if we can help, then help. And sometimes, like Sean said, we're really not helping when we're pursuing something. We are assuming we know something we don't know.
Well, and especially in the case of Job, he's never given them any reason to believe that he's in rebellion against God. And I think that when Job talks about himself, like we did in this last chapter, about I am a blameless and upright man, I think he's not boasting. He's rather trying to remind them, I haven't done anything wrong. Like, what are you accusing me of here? I mean, consider like the context of our entire relationship and tell me why you think I'm in rebellion. Yeah.
Okay, it is our human nature when things are going wrong to say, I did something wrong. I did, like, that is innate in us. So as someone who has walked through a lot in 5 years, you don't really have to come to me and ask, did you do anything wrong to deserve, like, that's running through our heads all the time. That's a demon we fight all the time. And so it's just not helpful, typically, to have someone else come and hash you something that, I can assure you, someone going through something hard is already reeling, going, what did I do? What did I do to deserve it? I mean, that's just innate. So to the point of compassion, I mean, yes, can people have blinders on? Like, can people be in something wrong and need help showing them? Yes, at times. So it doesn't mean that we just can never question it, you know, or never want to, you know, rebuke or help a brother in the wrong. So we can't take that pendulum too far. But at the same time, like, people are thinking that, you know, you lose a baby, you go through, you know, they're dealing with that. They don't really need people hashing it in them. So,
yeah.
You know, we just,
yeah.
That's just not something that you're like, you know, it just never occurred to me. I did something wrong to deserve this. Like, that's already happened.
Your point is very well taken, and it's very much going on with Job. He's very much there. And in chapter 13, you know, we jump ahead a little bit. In verse 23, in chapter 13, he says, how many are my iniquities and my sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Why do you hide your face and count me as your enemy? I mean, Job's asking these questions of himself. He doesn't need his friends to point it out. Yeah. Yeah, no, very, very good point. So we've got like 2 minutes left, so I'm not going to get into chapter 13 much anymore, but I'll go ahead and plan on sending the write-up. Hopefully that's okay. If this structure becomes problematic for people, y'all need to let me know. We can think of something else. There's other options that doesn't require me to teach for 8 years. So we can figure something else out if it's not working. But let me know. I'll plan on doing the write-up on chapter 13. And, you know, if you have anything you want to contribute, please don't take the email as an indication of just one-way communication. You know, I want people to reply to that, give your thoughts, ask your questions. If we can get some conversation going through email while we're not together, that would be a good thing. Or if you don't want to share anything with everybody, you can just send it to me. That would be encouraging to me, and be happy to answer questions or chat with you about it. So, for the first time ever, we're going to end 2 minutes early. Thank you.